It now gives me the greatest pleasure to introduce David Swanson. Most of you are here because you know who David Swanson is, but just to touch some of his highlights, he was press secretary for Dennis Kucinich's 2004 presidential campaign. He is co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org, creator of ConvictBushAndCheney.org, and the Washington director of Democrats.com, and a board member of Progressive Democrats of America, the Backbone Campaign, and Voters for Peace. And in his spare time, he travels around and talks to people. I think of David as the Thomas Paine of our time, and it is thrilling that he is here to talk to us in person tonight. There will be time for questions and answers after his talk, so please hold your questions until the end. David.
Thank you. Thank you to Anna and Alice and Julie and PDA and all of the groups I can't remember all at once. And I've thought long and hard about this unitary executive, and I would greatly prefer to, for once, get a Unitarian executive. I'm doing this. I've been to 40-some cities, and maybe half of the events have been at Unitarian churches, so I'm grateful for them. I was in Virginia this morning. We started this project in Virginia, growing this big community garden, and we've been, you know, working on it for years, digging irrigation ditches to get the water to the garden, you know, and it's hard work. It's a long-term project, you know, and these people came up with this idea, well, let's just have a rain dance instead. And we'll do the biggest, most marvelous, most hopeful, expectant rain dance ever. And we did, and it was the biggest success. And it started to sprinkle a little bit, and people started to think that, you know, maybe this was going to work. This was a rain dance that was supposed to take care of the garden for 4 years. We weren't going to have to do any of the necessary work for 4 years, and it was going to be rain we could believe in and so forth. And you know, so now, you know, everybody's upset that maybe it did. We thought we were trying to tell ourselves it worked, but it's getting harder and harder. Maybe it didn't. Maybe it didn't work. And, you know, people in past years would break down and get exhausted and give up and need a break from activism, and they'd come back. But it was always, you know, a handful here and there. You know, now, post-rain dance, you know, everybody's depressed and despairing, and, oh, it didn't work, you know. And you ask, well, did you really think that a rain dance worked? Oh, no, I didn't think that. But, well, then why are you upset now and not last year and not the year before and not the year before? Why now? Why is everybody upset now? Unless it's because they thought this crazy thing that has almost nothing to do with anything was going to solve all of our problems. And to make this rather blatant metaphor more direct, I think Emma Goldman was right when she said that if elections ever changed anything, they would be banned. I think that I think that we have dug those ditches quite a ways. We're quite a ways along toward where we need to be, and we know how to do it. And we have turned this country against wars. We have moved public opinion so dramatically against war lies that they can't tell lies about Iran because they're so similar to the lies about Iraq. We did that. And we know what more we need to do. And now is the time to do it. And it's just sort of silly to be upset that something magical didn't break into that and take over for us. And we've been handed today in the news the golden opportunity we needed. We needed an opportunity to say to our representatives in the House of Representatives to represent us. And that is not to agree with us in their hearts or say pleasant things or introduce bills to oppose wars, which then if they passed would have to pass the Senate and the President, but to vote no on war money. And today we were told that there's going to be a request for the second of what were not to happen anymore, these supplemental spending bills. You'll recall last June when progressive Congress members who had voted against war money time and again voted for the supplemental because it was going to be the last one, right? We weren't going to have any, so by then we were going to have one, but it was going to be the last one. Like, I'm going to kill one more kid because it's the last one. That justifies it. You know? And it wasn't, of course, the last one. They told us the next day that it wasn't the last one. And here comes the next one, $33 billion. They want $33 billion for the wars. And at the same time, the president is now asking for his second in a running streak of largest military budgets in the history of the galaxy, 700 some billion dollars, not counting State Department, Energy Department, CIA, etc. So, you know, I think we should be grateful that we have not just that to oppose, but the supplemental spending bill to oppose, because this is our chance to either win and block it and end these wars, for which we only need the House, and the Senate and the President can do whatever they feel like, but they can't fight wars, or to build the movement and affect the elections and affect the discussion and win next year. This is how it's done. You don't have to win immediately for it to help. There are, of course, huge military budgets all through the government, including the CIA, and friends of many of ours, I'm sure, are going to the CIA this weekend to protest there. The flying of the unmanned aircraft, which don't put the right people at risk, except when somebody comes and blows himself up in their offices and or flies on an airplane in this country and so forth. But I also persuaded them to take a march down the street to the next door neighbor of the CIA headquarters, Mr. Dick Cheney, and protest his ongoing activities. But that kind of stuff is educational. You know, the CIA, we don't elect them, we don't fund them, we don't pressure them. It's to educate the public and to educate the Congress. But the pressure goes to the Congress. If you want to imagine what we need to do, I think you just have to imagine that the Republicans were in charge, or even just in charge of the White House. President McCain was president, and think about what we would do. That's exactly what we need to do right now. I mean, imagine if it were President McCain proposing the biggest military budgets in history. Imagine if, because it was President McCain, the peace movement hadn't been defunded and demobilized and it was out there active and growing. And imagine if it was President McCain going and giving speeches in Europe glorifying war, you know, whether it was to accept a peace prize, as in the case of President Obama or otherwise. The outrage and the opposition, and what would we be doing? We would not be lobbying President McCain. You know, we might be protesting him, but we wouldn't be lobbying him and expecting him to listen to us and expecting for the first time in history to be able to go and easily persuade a president. And we would understand the difficulty of going after the Senate. We would be building on what we were doing in recent years and pushing the House of Representatives to cut off the money. And that means, I'm sorry, I've been talking all day. That means lobbying. It means media pressure. It means going after their funders. It means electoral challenges. It means sitting in their offices and disrupting their work. It means, yeah, setting aside this idea that politeness is a top value right now, while these people are allowing massive murder. We know this. We've figured out what needs to be done. And, you know, I think it was Churchill who said, you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And we've tried everything else. We know what's needed. It's to pressure these people like we meant it and to build the massive movement that's needed to do it and to send people in to sit in offices until they agree to what we demand, what the majority of their constituents demand. I've got five of them, thanks. you guys are prepared. And send people in to an office and have them sit there and go to jail and then hold a press conference and a rally outside the office the next day and present awards to the heroes of the previous day and send more people in. And keep doing it. There's a website at defundwar.org that has a chart of where all the Congress members in the House stand on funding wars and committing to not funding wars. One of the nice efforts that's already been announced is PDA's brown bag lunches on, I guess, the third Wednesday of every month, starting this time, starting on the 20th. And, you know, it's interesting to be in Congresswoman Woolsey's district talking about this because she votes better than almost any of the rest of them. And yet I think we have to break out of this idea that an elected official is on our team or on our side and with us or against us, all good or all bad, you know, because absolutely every single one of them needs to be rewarded for their good deeds and punished for their bad deeds. That includes all of them. And that kind of behavior builds a better relationship with them than kissing up to them does, you know? You don't see Dick Cheney kissing up to Barack Obama, and he's getting everything he demands of him. You don't, even if it's a congresswoman that is voting better than 400 other people, there are things that many people in this room would be doing better if they were in her seat. And that means go out and make public statements demanding that your colleagues vote no on the war money. Publicly and privately organize, whip your colleagues to vote no on the war money. It can't be just personally voting no on the war money. It has to be whipping and organizing and publicly on camera stating your demands. And stop supporting pro-war candidates. Why would Congresswoman Woolsey go down to the southern part of this state and oppose our friend Marcy Winograd, who would be far and away the best member of Congress if she's elected, in order to support Jane Harman, who can't make up her mind whether she works for the United States or Israel, who's listened to in that regard by the NSA, and rather than exposing that, complies with being blackmailed to go and shut down the New York Times story so that we don't learn about the warrantless spying, even though she herself is a victim of it, allowing George W. Bush to be quote-unquote reelected. And you're going to go and support someone like that rather than build a progressive caucus. I mean, this is the central demand for the best members of Congress who vote right personally. Make a caucus that's a caucus. The Blue Dog Caucus, half the members of the progressive caucus, they take a stand, they say, we won't vote for that bill unless you make it worse in the following ways, and then they vote for it. And they have an impact. The progressive caucus is the biggest caucus there is, and it's nothing but resume padding. There's no requirements to join it. It never does anything. It puts out statements. They put out a nice statement today on the health care bill. They had already caved and voted for a health care bill that they had opposed. I would rather have a caucus of 20 members that did something than a caucus of 85 members that never does anything but talk better. So So you can push those demands on the best of them. And you can educate. You can go out and educate people, and you know that you're guaranteed that you're accomplishing things and doing good. We're not going to win everything we need this generation. We need to reach out to young people above all. When I was in Oregon, they decided at the end of the event to have a book, to start a book discussion club and read my book and discuss it, and hopefully other good books down the line. When I was in Massachusetts, they have a congressman named Della Hunt that they were calling Della Won't and simply writing off. And not that they had never been active before, but they said, okay, we'll listen to you. And they went and they sat in his office and they refused to leave until he would meet with them to discuss the war money. And they did it, and now he's meeting with them to discuss the war money. So I want to hear feedback from this beautiful part of the country that I'm getting this brief glimpse of, what you guys are doing. I have good friends here like Sophie DeVries, who couldn't make it, and Norman Solomon, although his book and movie were here. There's wonderful, great people here to do things. And it's enjoyable. Whether you win immediately, whether you move any of these people immediately or not, you can look at medical studies that will show you it is good for your health to be doing it rather than sitting home and complaining. So, you know, it's not my advice. It's your doctor's advice. One of the themes of my book is power and where it is in Washington, because we all know that we have to get the money cleaned up, which we should be doing at the state and local levels as a step, and we know that we have to get the media fixed. That's our number one weakest link. But it matters whether all of the powers that are being abused are in the hands of one person or in a legislative body, right? And we've given the power to make war, the power to raise and spend money, the power to spy without warrant and imprison without charge and rendition and torture, the powers to make treaties and appointments without Congress. We've given everything to the president. Not just the last president, not just the current president, but every future president. Because if the new Congress had come in this year, last year, and said, Bush and Cheney went too far, we're going to roll that back, then we might have saved things. But for the new Congress and the new president to come in and in every case cement in place and expand and strengthen the powers claimed by Bush and Cheney makes it infinitely harder for any future government to undo that. You know, I was upset, and I look at in the first chapter of my book this innovative use of signing statements that Bush and Cheney came up with, where you sign a bill into law and then you write a statement changing parts of it and instructing the departments of the government not to comply with the law but to comply with your statement. This was new. But it did have the advantage of a public declaration. Once Charlie Savage at the Boston Globe clued everybody into what was happening, it was an announcement of criminal intent. And that had a certain advantage that I didn't fully appreciate. You know, and you have that when President Obama goes to the National Archives and stands in front of the Constitution and throws out habeas corpus, or goes to Oslo and declares the power to launch aggressive wars without the Congress. You have a public announcement of what's happening. But according to the analysis that Charlie Savage printed in the New York Times last weekend, which apparently only right-wing blogs have any interest in, what President Obama has decided to do is, if there's a previous signing statement by himself or President Bush that undoes a particular bit of legislation and Congress insistently passes it again, he'll just keep quiet and assume that that law is no good and not comply with it, and let Congress think otherwise if they choose. But if it's a new offensive bit of legislation that hasn't been dealt with by any signing statement or executive order or executive decree or unconstitutional treaty, well, then President Obama will go to the Office of the Legal Counsel in the Justice Department and say, write me a memo legalizing the violation of this law. We know this because he's produced such memos publicly. We don't know what memos have been produced privately in the past 12 months. This is the office that produced the notorious memos legalizing aggressive war and legalizing torture. These are the memos written under not just the well-known now book author celebrity John Yoo, but his boss, Jay Bybee, who has a lifetime seat on the appeals court in the Ninth Circuit in this part of the country, overturning the rulings of decent judges, which was his reward for what he did there. If the new Congress and the new president had come in and said, well, we're throwing out those memos, you can't have secret memos legalizing blatant crimes and call those laws, then it would be reasonable to assume they weren't continuing that practice and that future presidents couldn't either. But to have the new president come in and say publicly to the Justice Department, you cannot prosecute these people, and at best you can prosecute people who strayed from the particular sadistic torture policies outlined in these memos, thereby strengthening them, then you have to wonder what's going on. And when you take something that was a felony in each and every instance of complicity in torture was a felony under two statutes and numerous treaties before Bush was president, and you come in and say, well, I'm going to ban torture with an executive order, and your top advisors and that new head of the CIA make clear to the media that the new understanding is that you could torture if you want to, you're just choosing not to at the moment, and torture is, of course, ongoing because it's been made clear that it won't be prosecuted, then you're weakening the rule of law while giving the impression of complying with it. And this is disturbing as well. So things are as bad as you think they are, if not worse. And that is exactly why we have to get active and fix things. Not that we haven't been, not that we aren't tired already, but that we have to do more. And those who are working all out already have to get other people to do more. One thing we don't need to do to anything like the extent that we usually think is persuade other people to agree with us. Because on many, many of these issues where we think we're some fringe group out there on the side, we are a strong majority. And it doesn't change anything instantly, but it does encourage us and empower us to realize that. So reading from a page in my book, 67% favor public works projects to create jobs. 73% want corporations to pay a fair share of taxes. 76% want tax cuts for lower and middle income people. 80% want a higher minimum wage. 70% want habeas corpus rights for all prisoners and detainees. 58% want a court warrant before our telephones are listened to. And pages and pages of this, 60, 80, 90% on all of these issues. So it's important to know that, but we are lagging in activism, in people doing anything about it. There, we are a minority. And, you know, there was a nice study done where people were shown the federal budget and what money goes where, and you had a strong majority say, take at least a third out of the military and put it into useful things. Right? That's where the American people are. But what are they going to do about it? And that's where some members of Congress are, who don't do anything more about it than people who sit at home on their couch and complain. You know, you get, there's a website called Open Left that today posted an email from an unnamed progressive freshman Congress member, sounded just like any of us, but not even willing to put their name on their disappointments. That being said, we are far more active and involved than we realize as well. And the media doesn't tell us about it, and we have to tell each other about it. And there are people making huge sacrifices and doing great works for peace and justice that just aren't on television and aren't in stories. And when we win things, that part of the story is left out. Right? When we decide not to put a base in the Czech Republic for so-called missile defense, We're just told that that's kissing up to Russia. And we're just not told that a handful of people organized their whole nation and said, no, you can't put a base here if you want to. That part is always left out. In local stories, in state stories, in national stories, we aren't told that part of the story. There's a long list of local and state victories in my book, but I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, and we have to build on those. All of these resolutions that have been passed almost everywhere opposing parts of the Patriot Act, that's built the push that is part of the fight now when the Democrats now want the Patriot Act, and that battle is going on in Congress. There are resolutions being passed now in various cities saying if particular war criminals set foot here, they will be arrested, including Bush, including Cheney. You know, wouldn't it be nice if John Yoo and Condoleezza Rice and some of these war criminals inhabiting the Bay Area couldn't come across the bridge? Wouldn't it be nice if you passed resolutions and then you went and strung a banner across the bridge and said they can't come up here or they'll be arrested? This is perfectly achievable. So, you know, work on local resolutions, build media outlets, clean up elections locally and at the state levels, create credit unions and take your money out of the banks, and work on counter-recruitment, where we're having more victories than anywhere I know of, getting the tests out of the schools, getting the recruiters out of the schools, getting the uniformed generals out of the kindergartens. This is a good way to win victories that then encourage people to work on the hard stuff. The hard stuff where, you know, we are winning things as well that get buried. You know, the fact that we made the Iraq War illegal at the United Nations got immediately buried in the fact that we didn't stop it from happening. But that's going to allow us to hold these people accountable, as they may very soon be held accountable in England just for being our sidekicks. We've prevented a war on Iran. We've kept Social Security there. You know, these are things that there's not going to be an announcement of on a particular day, but that we've done every day. And the one that I really love and in retrospect think was a valuable victory for how it was done was kicking Alberto Gonzalez out of town. Not that he wasn't immediately replaced by somebody who did exactly the same thing that he would have done, but it was the way that we did it that we could employ again. Do you remember what made him leave town? Thank you. Alberto Gonzalez was threatened with impeachment. And he was dragged before committees and forced to testify and embarrass himself and say, I do not recall, sir. But he willingly did. These people have no shame. He was happy to do that and stay in office. It was the fact that one Congress member put in a bill with one sentence in it that said, the House Judiciary Committee shall consider whether the Attorney General has committed impeachable offenses. Right? And you got dozens of co-sponsors signing on, and he quit and left. Why? For the same reason he sneezed or tied his shoes, because Bush told him to. And why? Because if you have an impeachment hearing of a subordinate of the president committing crimes at the behest of the president, and it's an impeachment hearing, you're in a little bit of trouble because you can't say no to an impeachment hearing. You can't say state secrets, executive privilege, or go Dick Cheney yourself. You say, here's what you asked for. Right? What was Richard Nixon almost impeached for right before he left, before they could impeach him? For refusing to comply with an impeachment hearing. They wanted the tapes. They wanted the documents. What if we wanted, you know, the American public will not do what's needed on torture, for example, on the basis of words. We are not literate people. But if we could demand photos and videos and they couldn't say no, we'd have something to work with, right? So, you know, I would be offended to live here where the highest court has on it, as a judge, a man who has put down in writing his confessions to the supreme crime of mass murder, who has legalized illegal war, not to mention drafted sadistic personalized torture memos for individuals. Jay Bybee is sitting on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Why could not someone like Congresswoman Woolsey introduce a one-sentence bill? If it's too much work, we'll write it for her. With Jay Bybee in there instead of Alberto Gonzalez. We'd have something to work with. And, you know, if she won't do that, how about Tim Geithner? I mean, it's not like we have a shortage of people to impeach. But the impeachment power was set aside 3 years ago, and they spent 2 years pretending to do something less than impeachment, which if any of us said no to, we'd go to jail. They sent subpoenas to Cheney and Rice and all the rest of them, dozens of subpoenas. And they all said, no, I got to go shop for shoes that day. Go ahead without me. Right? Just as Jay Bybee said to Senator Leahy back in April when the torture memos came out. And Senator Leahy said, I'm sorry I troubled you. Not a single subpoena reissued in 2009. Not a single one. It was a pretense of giving a damn for 2 years. Because no committee has the guts to enforce its own subpoenas, as was done for the better part of U.S. history. And the new Justice Department won't enforce them. So we need to restore the power of impeachment and the power of subpoena. I mean, volunteer to be the person subpoenaed. I don't care, but get that power back. Otherwise, Congress can't be listened to and Congress can't make laws because it doesn't matter what Congress does. So we have to break out of the idea that I hear on peace group listservs that we need to make the case better, the intellectual case for against these wars and against these crimes. You know, there's not an intellectual case for these wars to oppose. We have to break out of the idea that politeness is what's going to do it, or that electing a whole bunch of new faces who will feel even more pain in their hearts when they vote the money for these wars than the last crowd is going to do it. You know, we have to back the exceptional candidates, the activist candidates, the people who will do what you and I would do if we were there, people like Marcy Winograd in Southern California. And we have to work with groups that aren't astroturfing. The vast majority of groups on the left as well as the right, the vast majority of labor unions are going to the White House, to the congressional leadership, to the Progressive Caucus in some cases, and saying, what would you like us to have people rally for you to do? And then going out and holding rallies and saying, here are the demands we want to make of Congress. When labor unions with 85% of their members wanting single-payer health care went around the country with buses and held rallies and said, you can't have any signs that say single-payer because what we want is a public option, that was making people props. That was them telling you what to do, not you telling them what to do. And that means a lot of organizations have to be reformed from the inside or they have to be abandoned. And you have to work with the good organizations, many of whom are here and sponsoring this event, and PDA and Vets for Peace. And, you know, PDA, with the name of the party in its name, is much more independent of the party leadership than just about any group coming out of Washington. As is Democrats.com. You have to work with or create the right groups that are not partisan, that are not on the side of a party, and get out of this idea of supporting elected officials who are supposed to be public servants. And I think we have to sort of stop wasting any time bashing Republicans. Not that they aren't fun to bash and don't deserve it, but because the American public is already ahead of us. We already voted them out of power. We gave the Democrats everything they wanted. The White House, big majority in the House, big majority in the Senate. You know, and don't talk to me about the filibuster, which Harry Reid could throw out tomorrow. 50 senators can throw out the filibuster rule if they are keeping it around as an excuse they're keeping it around as an excuse, and we have to tell them that we're on to them and don't buy it, and it's not an excuse. And so it's fun to see Congress members speak up against the Republicans' lies and racism and incitements of violence and the rest of it, and that needs to be done. But pretending that the Republicans are relevant to legislation and major policies when they've been voted out of power misses this golden opportunity to have people say, hey, wait a minute, giving one party complete power doesn't change all that much. Maybe we should hold each representative accountable for good and bad, regardless of parties. That would be a dramatic shift in this country. And I think making that demand to throw out the filibuster is a wonderful idea. You can go to endthefilibuster.org and sign a petition that Jonathan Tessini has just created that's going to be delivered to every senator and every candidate for senator. Does everybody know who Jonathan Tessini is? He is running for Senate in the state of New York, and he would be far and away the best senator we would have in the Senate if he wins. You may not have heard about him because the New York Times is running lengthy articles about all sorts of people who are thinking about maybe running for the Senate in the state of New York, but not on a guy who actually is running. And the fact that he was the plaintiff in the lawsuit that forced them to pay their reporters money when they put their articles on the internet, you know, could be related. I don't know. But we have to spread the word about people like this. And, you know, I used to work for a group called Acorn that's been attacked savagely. If you look, you know, below the very surface level of any of these attacks, there's nothing there. So you have to wonder why. Well, because they were succeeding. And the successes are not talked about the way the vicious attacks are talked about, right? Attacked for creating the problems on Wall Street that Acorn was demanding policies that would have prevented. Attacked for registering Mickey Mouse to vote. You know, despite the fact that you have to turn in every form so that you can't be throwing out the Republican ones, and if it says Mickey Mouse, you flag it as suspicious and turn it in, and as they did in each and every case. And by the way, Mickey Mouse never actually voted, so it didn't actually affect an election the way that election fraud and the rigging of machines and the rest of it does affect elections. But I think of the campaigns that we ran with Acorn that took years. And we went after, for example, a company called Household Finance that used to be all over the country making loans, many of them viciously predatory and dishonest rip-off loans that stole people's houses from them. And so we would have days of national action sitting in their offices all across the country. And we would have testimony in Congress where all the examples of bad behavior came from them. And we would pass local and state laws preventing what they were doing with all the examples presented from them. We would have loan counselors using, yes, that tidbit of federal money that goes to Acorn to make people good loans and get them out of the ones with household. And then we took buses full of people who'd lost their homes to this company to these incredibly wealthy suburbs north of Chicago where the CEO and all the board members live, and held rallies in all of their front yards and posted big wanted posters with their crimes all over the neighborhood. And then they wanted to sit down and talk with us. And they gave people $500 million, the biggest settlement other than the cigarette companies, because we tried every angle for years and didn't give up. And I think that's what we have to do. So let me close with a quote from the front of my book and then take any questions and discussion you want. And this is from a reporter named I.F. Stone. The only kinds of fights worth fighting are those you are going to lose. Because somebody has to fight them and lose and lose and lose. Until someday, somebody who believes as you do wins. In order for somebody to win an important major fight 100 years hence, a lot of other people have got to be willing, for the sheer fun and joy of it, to go right ahead and fight, knowing you're going to lose. You mustn't feel like a martyr. You've got to enjoy it. Thank you. Feel free to stand up and introduce yourself if you're so inclined or not. There's a microphone coming.
Jonathan Tessini was the president of the National Writers Union at one point.
Yes, he was.
I was a grievance officer at that time in New York City. My question, Alan Grayson, what say you?
Well, I say number one, because I've been in a number of cities where people have, much less satisfactory representation than you do here, and they ask me, can Alan Grayson be our savior? I say to them primarily, you need 218 people, so no one guy is going to be our savior. But my opinion of Alan Grayson is that he has done some remarkable things. He's pushed this bill that now has a vast majority of co-sponsors, if we could just get a vote, to audit the Fed, to let the Congress not control our money as the Constitution requires, but just see what's happening with our money. Alan Grayson was out ahead of Jonathan Tessini with a petition to Senator Reid saying, let's change the filibuster rule to 55 instead of 60. Which is progress, but he sort of framed it just around the health care bill as if it was just to get that bill through and so on. But to publicly lobby a senator in your party is almost unheard of. This is the sort of thing that I'd like to see Congresswoman Woolsey doing, publicly lobbying Pelosi for the things we demand. And Congressman Grayson was willing to do that. That being said, much of what Congressman Grayson has done, as with Congresswoman Woolsey or any of them, is talk better than the average Congress member. And it's nice to denounce how awful the Republicans are on health care and to not cave into them and to stand up to them. But we already voted them out of power, and it would be nice if the Democrats would do something decent on health care. And I got an email from Grayson saying, Dick Cheney's still on the loose. Dick Cheney's not behind bars yet. Send me money, right? And this was in the days following him refusing to cave to the Democrats on health care. And people sent him $500,000. And I looked into it, what was he going to do to hold Dick Cheney accountable? I wanted time to sell my house and put in everything I could. And you know what he was going to do? Go on television and call Cheney a vampire. Which, if you will forgive me, has no teeth to it. It doesn't do anything. He has not done a goddamn thing to hold Dick Cheney accountable for anything except talked about it to raise money. And he has done more good things on other issues than other Congress members, and he's to be applauded for that. But when you talk about something and you don't have any intention to do anything about it, that annoys me. Yes, sir.
Alan Horn, Veterans for Peace. Our Constitution has been so perverted, and you've outlined a number of these perversions. One of them that I feel very strongly about is the legalization of torture. Now, it looks like in California this year we're going to be able to vote on a constitutional convention and rewrite the Constitution of the state of California. What do you think about doing this in the United States?
I think it's long, long overdue. I think ultimately it is absolutely essential. I think the people who wrote the thing would be appalled that we've gone 2 1/4 centuries without a convention. Convention, the word convention, when they used it, was a word that conveyed the ultimate power of revolutionary representation of the people that is outside the established rule of law. You've fought a revolution. Now you hold a convention of ad hoc representatives of this new will, and you establish a new regime. And they built into the Constitution, two ways that things are done. The ordinary day-to-day pass laws through Congress and have them judged by the Supreme Court and enforced by the President and so on. But when things get out of hand or times change and something more authoritative is needed, then you have these mechanisms for the people, the true sovereigns, to assert their will and establish new standards for all three branches. And, you know, the amendment by amendment way, we've barely used it all. You know, we had 12 original ones. We got 11 of them. We got another 16 over 2.25 centuries. One of them to get rid of alcohol. Another one to bring it back. You know, most of them to tweak how you elect the president. I mean, we've barely touched the thing. It has no positive rights in it. It's just stuff you can't do. There's no right to health care. There's no right to vote. There's no right to a decent standard of living. There's no right to an education. We are so far behind other constitutions and international treaties. That being said, you have to build towards it and be careful about how you do it and understand that if you simply allowed the state legislatures as they are now constructed to do it tomorrow, you would have AT&T and Lockheed Martin rewriting our Constitution. So you have to do it right. And we can do it step by step, and we can push individual amendments. But ultimately, we're going to need it. But, you know, long before we need it, we need the existing Constitution to be complied with. That would be a start. Well, I have little quibbles, but I think the fight that California Nurses and Donna Smith and PDA have pushed for single payer, along with other unions and groups, was absolutely the right thing, and will continue to be the right thing. And the ongoing push in a growing number of states and actions just this week here and in Vermont and in Pennsylvania and Ohio to keep up the push for state single payer is exactly the right thing to do. I think the deal that the so-called progressives in Congress cut with the president to self-censor and not make the initial demand be for single payer constrained the debate to start with this pathetic public option and negotiate down from there. And there just wasn't very far to negotiate down. And I think that that's not the way it's done. And unions know this. All unions should know it, but the California Nurses Association acts on it. You don't open your negotiation with the lowest you'll take. You know, it doesn't work out well that way. That being said, you know, I was disappointed with all the public action, the public option groups, in that they wouldn't say anything about single payer. They wouldn't say, we want single payer, but we'll take a public option, and they wouldn't say a word about state single payer. And when Congressman Kucinich's amendment facilitating state single payer was passed in committee in the House and then unceremoniously stripped out by Pelosi and not in the bill, there was no major fight for that. And the single payer advocates didn't lift their little finger for it either, because they wanted national single payer for everybody immediately. And so do I, you know. But I would have loved to see both groups find common ground and come together around that point. And it's not too late. I mean, if a few dozen members of Congress said right now, put that language for state single payer back in this godforsaken bill that doesn't have anything else good in it if you want us to vote for it, and somehow convince them that for once they meant it or actually followed through and voted no and then they came back and did it again, then we would have something worthwhile. And so that the division between the public option people and the single payer people and the inability of either group to come together on something like that that would let states do it, which is the way we're going to get it done, that was disappointing.
When do you run for office?
Well, let me answer this guy really quickly and then come to you, sir. I live in Southern Virginia. I will not pretend to believe in God. I like to write books. I don't like to do things that Congress members do, which is mostly beg for money. But thank you, and I think you should run for office too. Okay. I remember. Yes.
We weren't successful. But not only the new president, who's committing war crimes and doing many of the same things that have continued, you haven't mentioned the teabaggers yet. And I'm thinking, well, is there some progressive way of activists and the radical left inviting teabaggers into community conversations and pushing for an impeachment of Obama and a real radical change from the bottom up?
Well, the last bit is the trickiest, because when they won't even impeach Bush or Cheney, to get them to impeach Obama is going to be a little bit of an uphill climb. But getting teabaggers to come to events and talk to them is a lot easier. The most difficult part of it, of course, is finding any of them, because they are indeed a fringe little regional minority within a minority party. But they are incredibly overrepresented on television. So we have to talk about the danger they represent and their threats of violence and their racism and the rest of it and the influence they have on the discussion. We do not have to talk about them as if they really are a major segment of U.S. opinion and give them that respect. But, you know, a lot of people who are either teabaggers or rightward-leaning activists, the people who now are more active or at least more publicized in their activism than we are, have a lot of legitimate grievances. There's a lot of common ground that we should have with these people. I can't imagine getting a single Democrat on board with impeaching Obama at this moment. But I can imagine getting a team of one or two Democrats and one or two Republicans in Congress to say, let's impeach Tim Geithner. Everybody's against the Wall Street bailouts. Everybody. Everybody's against a lot of the corruption and the system of how things are run in Washington and the inability to unelect anybody and the ballot access rules and the party dominance and the corporate corruption. And it gets turned toward racism and immigrant bashing and gay bashing, and it should be turned to things where we agree with people across these divisions. Our problem for people on the left is that they won't oppose Democrats. And the problem for people on the right is they don't want to work with the people on the left, but we have to do that. And there are these coalitions, and they do get formed. And there are libertarians who agree with us on the war, even if they disagree with me on everything else. And it's important to work with people where you agree with them. Absolutely.
Just on the issue of common ground between teabaggers and progressives, sent Udar on the Young Turks and Smoke and Chimp was blogging about this just the other day, and Glenn Greenwald was written about it too, just for information. David, I'd be really curious. It seems to me that our Democratic leadership is so often afraid of Republicans. It's a long-standing problem. During the Cold War, they were afraid of being called soft on communism. More recently, the fear is that they'll be called soft on terrorism. Socialists, what have you. How big a problem is this fear, these political fears on behalf of our Democratic leadership, and what can be done about it?
I think it's the biggest problem. I think that when you go and talk with Congress members or their staffers about why they won't do what most of their constituents want, the single most common answer is the media wouldn't like it. Fox News wouldn't like it. They would attack, you know. I went from working very closely with Congressman Conyers' office in 2005 and building a plan towards impeaching Bush for lying us into a war to sitting in Conyers' office and going to jail. And when he told us then, and repeatedly, I mean, he had a whole variety, but the most commonly repeated reason why was that, you know, Fox News would attack him, right? And this is what comes out of the Justice of the Judiciary Committee now, why they won't impeach someone like Jay Bybee. You know, the media wouldn't like it. He's a right winger. Fox News would hate it. You know, does John Conyers run the Judiciary Committee, or does Fox News run the Judiciary Committee? You know, they impeached a judge this year, but he wasn't a right winger, and he had groped his employees, right? This is it. If there's sex, if it's a Democrat, you can impeach somebody. That's not keeping the impeachment power in place. I think we have to stop supporting bad media outlets. You know, the next peace organization that buys a full-page ad in the New York Times and brags about it needs to go hunting with Dick Cheney. I mean, you can't... I mean, this is killing ourselves, right? You have to take the good media outlets that you think aren't big enough and make them bigger. And ultimately, we need media reform. We need serious private investment in independent media. I mean, the North American liberal is like the only subspecies that doesn't understand the importance of media. You know, every election cycle, we dump enough money into the corporate television networks through the campaigns that we could have created a television network that actually reported the news for all future elections. And yet we never do it, right? And we need public investment in independent media and in newspapers. And, you know, it's done in Europe. It can work. But we don't do it. It is the single biggest problem, but it can be overcome, and it's the easiest problem for people to work on because they can do it all by themselves. They can support good media outlets and stop supporting the bad ones. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David.